Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing Board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On an October night in 1905, a horrifying scene was found on a wooden vessel off the coast of Cape Fear, North Carolina. On board the Harry A. Berwind, one crewman lay dead, his blood streaming down the deck. The four officers were all gone, murdered too, it would turn out, their bodies dumped into the sea. Only three sailors remained alive, one tied up, all telling different stories, all blaming each other. The three sailors were black. The dead officers were white. So began a legal spectacle that would captivate much of the nation's press and fuel a sensational trial in Wilmington. It was in Wilmington, after all, that shocking racial violence had occurred not long before, and now the city remained in the clutches of white supremacists. Most observers could have predicted a quick verdict and a triple hanging, if not an even quicker lynching. Yet the legal drama would defy predictions, lasting 7 years, reaching the Supreme Court, pulling in Presidents Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft, then even twisted into a fanciful big-budget movie. In the end, so many participants, from jurors to lawyers to politicians, acted against type that justice had a fighting chance. The book that we're featuring this evening is Ship of Blood, Mutiny and Slaughter Aboard the Harry A. Berwind and the Quest for Justice, with my special guest, author and attorney, Charles Oldham. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Charles Oldham.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on this incredible tale.
Well, thanks.
Let's, as you do in the book, you introduce this area, Cape Fear, North Carolina. We all know about the movie and the remake of the movie starring Robert De Niro. Just tell us a little bit more about Cape Fear as you introduce this story.
Okay. Well, for anyone who is who's not familiar with North Carolina, and I am, because this is the area where I grew up, really. But these days, anyone who's familiar with Wilmington and the Brunswick County area, which is where Cape Fear actually is, these days it's the beach. It's a is a tourist community, and that's what all of life revolves around: the beach and seafood restaurants and sailing races and that type of thing, which is great. It's a wonderful place to vacation, wonderful place to live too. But I mean, for this story, we have to go back in time more than 100 years, because the case happened in the year 1905, and yeah, back in those days, it was life was hard in rural North Carolina back in that time. It was a pretty hard scrabble place to live, and Southport, Cape Fear, was a very small, you might say, shipping and fishing village where everything revolved around the shipping industry and fishing, that type of thing. And life was difficult, and people back then were very, very hard folks, you might say. They had to deal with a lot of struggles in their daily lives, and politics reflected that at the same time. Early 1900s were a very, very tumultuous time in politics of the area back in those days, and that's also what I try to convey in the book.
Let's get to October 10th, 1905, and you talk about a four-masted schooner, the Blanche A. H. King. Tell us, set the stage as you do, with Captain John Taylor, 8 officers and crew. What happens October 10th, 1905?
Well, the Blanche King, the sailing ship that you mentioned, was sailing along just off the coast of North Carolina, not far from Cape Fear, roughly 25 miles offshore. They were on their way to Philadelphia, carrying a load of lumber on board, and they happened to come across another vessel, sort of in the same shipping path, that was also headed towards Philadelphia. And that ship was known as the Harry A. Berwind. It's kind of interesting because sailing vessels back then, commercial vessels, typically were named after people, usually former ship captains or businessmen, officers in shipping companies, and that type of thing. So the names of these vessels were not particularly creative. They were just named after people. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I'll just call them the King and the Berwind. But the King was sailing along, and they came across the Berwind, another vessel of very similar size and dimensions. And the officers on board the King noticed that the Berwind was sailing pretty erratically. They were kind of zigging back and forth, and they didn't have their sails furled properly. And it was just, it appeared like there was something amiss on board the Berwind. And so the King, they drew up alongside the other ship, and they came within hailing distance, and the guys on board the King shouted out to Berwind and said, hey, what's wrong? And somebody shouted back from Berwind saying, we want to be taken off this ship because a man has gone crazy and he's killed all of the officers on board the ship. So when the fellows on board the King got into their lifeboat, they'll call it, and they went over to the other ship, they found a bloody scene. There was at least one man who was lying dead on board the deck of the ship. And there were 4 others, the officers on board the ship, who were also deceased. They had been shot and killed, and their bodies had been tossed overboard. So what they came across was essentially a mass murder scene.
What did they do as a result? You say, what did they exactly find? You say that they found a bloody scene, but they experienced something right away that they noticed with someone being tied up. So tell us what the exchange was and what they did witness.
Yeah, that's true. Originally on board the Berwind, there had been 8 men on board, 4 officers and 4 other guys whom I will call lower decks sailors. And all 4 of the officers were missing. It turned out that they had been shot and killed and thrown overboard. And of the 4 sailors, one of them also was lying dead. They found his body on the deck of the ship. One of them also had been tied up, bound hand and foot by the other 2 guys who were still alive and walking around. So it was clear that someone had obviously committed some murders, and although it wasn't entirely clear at first who had done what, because there were 3 people remaining alive on board the ship, and they started telling different stories, blaming each other as to who did what.
Okay, so 2 of the people, one's Arthur Adams, and another one is named Sawyer.
Robert Sawyer.
And the person tied up is named Henry Scott.
Yes.
So what do Adams and Sawyer have to say about what happened?
Well, they immediately blamed everything on Henry Scott. They claimed that Henry Scott had smuggled some weapons on board the ship. And they said that this came as a complete surprise to them, but they claimed that Henry Scott decided that he was going to kill all the officers on board the ship and take over the vessel. And they claim that that is what Henry Scott proceeded to do. He pulled out his weapons and he went and hunted down each of the officers one by one, shot and killed them and threw them overboard. And at the same time, they claimed that Henry Scott had held them under the gun, claiming that he would kill them, Adams and Sawyer, if they did not cooperate with him. And they claimed that that went on for several hours, and it was not until later that they were able to seize the opportunity to tackle Mr. Scott and beat him down and take his guns away from him and tie him up. And in the process, Scott apparently had shot and killed one of the other sailors, whose name was Coakley, and he was the one who was lying dead on board on the deck. That was their story. As you might imagine, Henry Scott, the other fellow, told a different story.
What was the different story that he had?
Well, Mr. Scott, as you might imagine, blamed it on all the other guys. He claimed that Adams and Sawyer and Coakley actually were the ones who brought guns on board the ship. And Scott claimed that he was innocent of that. And Mr. Scott claimed that the other three guys were the ones who conspired together to do the very same thing, kill all the officers, take control of the ship. And Scott, he essentially, as you might say, he flipped the script on the other three guys. He claimed that they came up with the idea of seizing the vessel, maybe taking it into port and trying to claim that the officers had drowned in a storm or something like that, and they might use this as a way to try to collect a reward from the shipping company for having salvaged the ship or something like that. And Mr. Scott, as you might imagine, also claimed that when he objected to this plan, that the other guys decided to tackle him and tie him down and so forth. So it was basically two guys against one telling completely different stories about what happened.
Now, you say that the Captain Taylor that was in charge of the King, he certainly wasn't a detective or law enforcement, so he had all three handcuffed. He couldn't sort out who was guilty of what, so he played it safe and had these people handcuffed and then escorted into Wilmington, I believe. From there, what happens in terms of law enforcement's involvement?
Well, they escorted the Berwind into the nearest port, which was actually Southport, North Carolina, which is a small town, which is just at the mouth of the Cape Fear River, just a short distance downriver from Wilmington, which is the major city in the area. But you're correct. I mean, both ships were then taken into Southport, and Captain Taylor from the King then turned all three of those guys over to the custody of federal marshals in the area, because it was a federal case. It was a mutiny and a mass murder that took place on board on the high seas. So essentially, it turned into a federal mutiny and murder prosecution, and the trial was held in Wilmington, North Carolina, just a few weeks afterward.
You eventually talk about what is at play at this preliminary that starts in 1905. Mm-hmm. We alluded to it in the introduction about what happened in 1898 in Wilmington. And obviously, this trial is influenced by what happened in 1898 and all of the events and the environment and atmosphere that occurred before 1905.
Yeah.
So now there's the media at play here and the phenomena of people that are interested in this case. Tell us about all of that backdrop to this preliminary trial.
Well, it was a very auspicious time because this was in 1905 when these murders took place. And the critical factor is that these three sailors who were put on trial for these murders, all three of them were of African descent. And as it turned out, all four of the officers on board the Berwyn who were murdered were white men. So three black guys put on trial for murdering four white men. And this was in Wilmington, North Carolina in 1905. And we have to take account of, as you said, what happened in Wilmington in 1898. This is a story that has gotten a lot of coverage in recent years from historians and the press, because it was a very shocking event, which was really didn't get a lot of coverage for a long time, which is unfortunate. It's only within the past 20 years or so that people have really become aware of what we now call the 1898 insurrection in Wilmington. But the long and short of it is that in 1898, Wilmington was a multiracial city, and very unusual for the South in those days. It had a multiracial government that had been elected in the mid 1890s, around 1894. They had black people and white people both serving in the city government. And things really came to a head in 1898 when something called the white supremacist movement spread across North Carolina. The Democratic Party, which was a completely different institution back then from what we know it as today, was staunchly white supremacist. And in the 1898 campaign, they really harped upon racial issues as a means of seizing control of the state government. And I try to be delicate in the way that I describe this, because it's so easy to give offense sometimes. Mm-hmm. But the campaign that they ran was absolutely brutal. They spread all kinds of rumors about black government officials preying on white women and that type of thing, and right. warning about the perils of what they called Negro domination in state government. Again, I apologize to even use language like this, but that's mm-hmm. those were the dynamics of the situation. But again, to kind of cut to the chase, in 1898, these white supremacist Democrats took complete control of North Carolina state government in that election. And as a result of that, in Wilmington, there was a very bloody situation in which the local white supremacists, they decided that winning the election was not enough. They were going to seize physical control of the city government by killing people. And that's what happened. They staged an armed insurrection in the city where they physically evicted the white people and a lot of the blacks who had been involved in the city government, and they marched through the streets with guns, and they went about killing people. There were probably about 60 people who ended up lying dead in the streets as a result of that. It really was a bloody governmental coup d'etat, probably the only documented case where that has actually happened in the United States. It's a very, very regretful thing for anyone who's from North Carolina to know about. And that's unfortunately why the story remained hidden for so long. A lot of us didn't learn about it in high school because it's so shameful. But as a result of that, in 1898, Wilmington, North Carolina was the governmental institutions, the courts, everything was completely dominated by white supremacists. And therefore, that was the environment that these three black guys were facing when they were put on trial for murdering these white men in 1905.
You also talk about that it was set that they would have two separate trials, that Adams
and Sawyer
would both have a separate trial as opposed to Henry Scott. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that the dynamics of those, both of those trials would be that Scott would be the star witness in the Adams and Stewart trial and vice versa.
Yeah.
Adams and would be witness at the Scott trial. So other than that, who, if anyone, is there to represent, talk about the representation of Adams and his partner and Henry Scott.
Well, the interesting thing is, and you're correct, I mean, there were two trials. Adams and Sawyer were tried together because they were telling the same story. They were blaming Scott. And then Scott was tried separately because it was just the opposite. Scott was alleging that Adams and Sawyer were the killers. So yes, there were two separate trials, one right after the other. And total of three defendants. And one thing that is surprising to me is that all three of them had defense attorneys. And what's really ironic is that the defense attorneys who were appointed by the court were guys who came from the white establishment in Wilmington and whose families were staunch Democrats. And they had relatives who were actually involved in the events of the insurrection in 1898. Mm-hmm. In fact, they had been leaders of it. And yet here they were being appointed to represent these black guys in court. And what's really surprising is that they actually did their jobs. They did not shrink from the responsibility of representing these fellows and filing the appropriate motions. And I mean, they did the best they could in court. I mean, given the deck that was stacked against them, because these guys were put on trial in federal court, and the juries were called from taxpayer rolls and the jurors, as you might imagine, were all white men from Eastern North Carolina. And so, I mean, they had the deck stacked against them from the very beginning. But despite all of that, the trial procedures were followed. The law was followed, and the trial procedure was very deliberate and calm and professional, which is not exactly what you might expect. The verdicts were what you probably would expect, but I was frankly surprised by the sense of decorum in the courtroom. It was actually quite pretty calm and professional.
You write about the participation of the press and its influence. What did the press consider after hearing the very consistent testimony right from the very beginning and continuing to trial of Adams and Sawyer?
Well, it's just a little bit of the background. Adams and Sawyer were put on trial first, and Scott was the primary witness against them. And so the prosecutor, he I got the sense that he just wanted to get this over with as quickly as possible. He wanted to try all three of them, and he wanted to get death sentences against all three of them and then be done with it. So the prosecutor, when he put Adams and Sawyer on trial first, he simply brought in Scott to take the stand and give his testimony. And then Adams and Sawyer took the stand on their own behalf, told their story. And people noted that Adams and Sawyer in particular, they were very consistent in stories that they told. They seemed calm and sincere and so forth. So a lot of the press in Wilmington were actually impressed with Adams and Sawyer. Despite that, they were found guilty and they were immediately sentenced to death. All right. After that trial concluded, and the trial of Adams and Sawyer took about 3 days, about a half hour after that trial concluded, they simply started the second trial,
yeah.
Scott's. They just declared a recess. 30 minutes later, they filled the jury box with 12 more people, and they started the second trial. And then the prosecutor then brought in Adams and Sawyer to be his witnesses to testify against Scott, despite the fact that the same prosecutor had just gotten death sentences against them only hours before. Yeah. They now became his witnesses. They took stand, told the very same story that they had in their own trial. They said, Scott did it. And then, you know, Scott took the stand, told his story again in his own defense this time. He also was found guilty and sentenced to death. So it was, the whole thing was, I said just a moment ago that the trial process was very deliberate and calm, you know, probably a little too much so, because there was just a sense that all the attorneys just wanted to get it over and done with. And the judge wanted to be sure that he followed all the rules, dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's, and so that he wouldn't be overturned on appeal, probably. But, the trials were obviously a rush job. And the verdicts and the sentences were no surprise, and given the whole black-white dynamics of the thing. But what was surprising is that a lot of the people in the courtroom, and especially the press in Wilmington who were reporting on this, they actually listened to what these people were saying in court. And they were really impressed with Adams and Sawyer. They sounded sincere. And I hate to use the language that they used in print. They called them like a simple-minded, which is a racially loaded term. Mm-hmm. But they meant it as a compliment, sort of, because they sounded honest and it sounded like they were telling the truth. Whereas they noted that this guy, Scott, on the other hand, he seemed really slick and evasive. And again, this is a little offensive, but they said that he was unusually smart for a black guy, which led them to think, well, he's probably lying and he's probably the guilty one, which turned out to be true. But what really surprised me was that the press really were that discerning, and they were willing to say, you know, all three of these guys probably are not equally guilty, and all of them probably do not deserve to hang. And in fact, these were the same newspapers who just a few years earlier had been advocating in favor of the white supremacy movement, and they had all but they had been cheering on the sidelines when that insurrection happened and when people were being shot dead in the streets. But they were willing to acknowledge that, you know, this probably is a miscarriage of justice as far as Adams and Sawyer were concerned. So that was very surprising to me.
You noted what the press picked up on, but you also write that there was a financial consideration by the Berwind itself, the owners of the Berwind, to the verdict being just as it was. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the officers in the company that owned the Berwind, they did have a bit of a financial motive here, because they didn't want to have to pay out any what they would call salvage fees. Because if it turned out that any of the surviving crew members, if any of them had been found not guilty of the mutiny and the murder, then conceivably the shipping company might have been liable to pay salvage fees to either the crew of the King that had intercepted the ship, or conceivably even to the surviving sailors, Adams or Sawyer. So you might say that they had a financial motive to come into court and swear that all three of the guys had been actively involved in the mutiny and the murders. And the captain of the King and also the owners of the Berwind, they also testified in the trials to that effect.
You talk about the media as well. Did they not? You say that they concluded that somebody must be lying out of the three, mm-hmm. and somebody, if not two people, were innocent of the three.
Yeah, well, or at least they had doubts about it. It seemed like they figured out pretty early on that Henry Scott was a suspicious character. He just didn't look right. He didn't sound right. He just didn't sit right, you might say. And they had doubts about, you know, whether his story really held water, and it didn't.
So you say that the execution was set for shortly after for Scott and for Adams and Sawyer. What happens next in terms of their future?
Well, Adams and Sawyer, their attorney did file an appeal on their behalf. So again, I give their attorney credit for that, because he didn't just walk away once they were sentenced. And in fact, at that point, there was another attorney who came on board to represent them, to represent Adams and Sawyer on their appeal, which ultimately went to the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court. And that attorney's name was George Roundtree. And that was really fascinating to me, because he, in fact, had been one of the prime ringleaders of the insurrection back in 1898. He had been walking around in the streets. There's still some dispute about exactly how he was involved, but he probably was involved in coordinating the shootings and the demonstrations that ended up killing about 60 people. But he didn't have to do it. I can't imagine that he was being paid very much, but he willingly came into this case and he defended Adams and Sawyer and took their case to the U.S. Supreme Court. So again, that was very surprising to me. Scott's attorney did not file an appeal for him, because I think he realized that the writing was on the wall as far as he was concerned. But yes, the case, Adams and Sawyer, their case did go to the Supreme Court. They did not actually prevail in the Supreme Court, because, well, the issues that their attorneys were able to raise, the Supreme Court wasn't really looking at issues like the adequacy of defense counsels, and they weren't looking at racial issues at that point in time. You know, it wasn't until later, say the Scottsboro cases, and really much later in the 1950s and 60s when the federal courts really began to take seriously how racial prejudice, you know, interfered with due process of law in cases like that. So they did not win in the Supreme Court, but there was a very unforeseen surprise that came along, and I think you probably know what I'm referring to. There was the anonymous letter that appeared at the jail.
Yeah, let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Best Fiends. When I have some downtime, when not working on a podcast or reading a book to prepare, I take some time to play Best Fiends and lose myself in the game. I even lose track of time playing sometimes when I'm on a little winning streak, for example. What I love most about Best Fiends is the challenges, and I play whenever I want to unwind. I'm on level 820 right now, so many more levels that I want to achieve. Best Fiends is a mobile puzzle game that everyone can download and play. No matter how much time you have to play, you'll love the great escape Best Fiends offers. There are a lot of cool characters to help you solve all the thousands of puzzles. And the more characters you collect, the more challenges you face as you keep winning. There are challenging puzzles and new characters added all the time. And with thousands of levels, you'll never, ever get bored. Download Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Now, we talked about, Charles, about the surprise letter. What was contained in this anonymous letter that would help these two characters?
Well, it happened in the summer of 1906. It was about 7 or 8 months after the trials, when all three guys were in jail. They had been sentenced to death, and they were awaiting their execution dates. Somebody, and we don't know who, wrote a letter to Henry Scott in the jail, telling him to, well, alleging that Henry Scott had taken part in some other murders that supposedly happened in Alabama a couple of years before. And it also contains some hints that Henry Scott was involved in some kind of conspiracy of black militants that was taking place throughout in different states throughout the South, and they were planning to overthrow white supremacist governments. Now, that seems kind of far-fetched. And the jailers, when they read this letter, they didn't really take it seriously, but they thought, you know, we really need to look into this. And so what they did, they got up with this gentleman who was the rector of one of the Episcopal churches in Wilmington, and he was an African American priest who had been ministering to all three of these guys while they were in the jail.
Right.
So they talked with this priest, and they basically goaded him into prying Henry Scott for some information, trying to figure out if there was anything to these allegations of the other murders and the conspiracy and so forth. And we don't know exactly what the priest said to Henry Scott. It would be really, really neat to know how that conversation went. But he did talk with Scott, and it appears that he prevailed upon Scott to come clean, essentially.
Right.
And Scott eventually, as a result of this, I don't know his motives precisely, but he came around and he did confess to the murders. And again, his story was evasive. Again, and nobody really believed that he was telling the truth about how it actually happened. But he did come around and he said, Adams and Sawyer, in fact, were not involved in the murders. He said, I did the murders myself. So when when Scott did that, it immediately brought renewed hope to Adams and Sawyer, but they were still under sentence of death and they were only a few weeks away from being hanged. So their attorneys then went into overdrive and they started a new legal proceeding to try to save their lives.
To save their lives, there was a, you say they had a petition, but they had to speak to the president of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. So tell us about this journey to be able to achieve this. What happens along the way?
Well, that is true. And bear in mind, of course, it was a federal case. So clemency was in the hands of the president, who was Theodore Roosevelt at the time. Roosevelt, who frankly had never been known as being particularly friendly towards African-Americans or civil rights issues in general. But his attorneys, you know, like I said, they really went into overdrive and they prepared a clemency petition that was signed by some of the most influential folks in Wilmington's political and financial communities, including the very head ringleader of the insurrection. His name was Alfred Moore Waddell. And this is a really infamous name in North Carolina mm-hmm. these days because he's now known as the man who, back in 1898, he gave a speech that inspired the insurrection and the riot. And I'll give you the quote, although it is kind of shocking. He said, We will take over the city even if we have to choke the Cape Fear River with Negro carcasses, which is a very crude thing to say. And it resulted in, as I said, about 60 people being shot dead in the streets. But Alfred Moore Waddell, who gave that speech and became the mayor of Wilmington as a result of the insurrection, he actually signed the clemency petition for Sawyer and Adams, which was really astounding to me. Mm-hmm. I was very surprised when I saw that. And it took a lot of cajoling and some personal visits from the attorneys and several other people who were influential in Wilmington at the time. They met with Theodore Roosevelt. And it took him several months to come around, but he did. He commuted the sentences of Adams and Sawyer, commuted them from death to life in prison. Mr. Scott, meanwhile, had actually been, his death sentence had been carried out. He was hanged, and it was a pretty dramatic scene. In fact, he just a few hours before he was hanged, he finally put his signature on the written confession, which exonerated Adams and Sawyer. So it was the timing was just about as close as you could make it.
Right. So now they avoid being executed,
yes.
But they go to prison, these
yeah.
guys. And you titled this chapter, The Gates of Hell.
Yeah.
But this is a federal penitentiary or a federal prison, so it's better than if it were a state penitentiary. So you describe some of the, what you would call the Gates of Hell.
Well, it's kind of in the eye of the beholder. They were sent to the federal prison in Atlanta, which was, we can see pictures of it now. It was a big stone, forbidding looking fortress type of building, which had been built just recently. And you'd have to imagine that the conditions there could not have been great especially for these three black guys who had been, as I said, convicted of killing white men. This is arguable one way or the other, but the conditions, as tough as they were, they probably were better than if they had been sent to something like a chain gang working on roads or working in a cotton field in North Carolina. But again, that's debatable about which is worse. But one advantage is that because they were in the federal prison system, everywhere they went and everything they did was actually documented in the prison files, in the court files, which I count myself fortunate that I was able to find them because they're still in the National Archives these days. And I was able to find the letters that they wrote and who they communicated with. And because of that, I know that even though they were in prison, they didn't give up on the possibility of proving their innocence. And they kept it up. And they communicated with folks in Wilmington who were friendly with them. And they worked really hard to get a second presidential clemency proceeding.
And how do they do that? And who are some of the, or one of the allies in this fight?
Well, I don't want to give everything away at this point, but I will tell you that there was a chance encounter. Adams and Sawyer, they made the acquaintance of a fellow named Henry Warner, who was a well-known stage actor in the United States and frankly in England also, because that's where he was from originally. And this Mr. Warner, for reasons that are not entirely clear, he was really active in the prison reform movement back in those days. He was sort of like a celebrity activist in a way. But somebody introduced him to the fact that these two guys, Adams and Sawyer, were serving a life prison term for murders that they apparently didn't commit. And so eventually Mr. Warner decided that he was going to take an interest in their case, and he had money at his disposal, and he had attorneys that he was working with. And so Mr. Warner sent his attorneys down to Atlanta to meet with these guys and collect evidence and basically spearhead a second clemency petition, which they directed to William Howard Taft, who succeeded Theodore Roosevelt as president. Just a little bit of trivia here is that Henry Warner, he was back in the 1910 around that time, he was known for his stage work, but he continued acting in the silent film era and later into the 1930s and 40s. He also had a role in the well-known movie It's a Wonderful Life by Frank Capra. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to give it all away, but if you watch that movie, you know, like we all do at Christmas very often, if you see in the credits Henry Warner, you'll recognize the name and you'll see him there.
We don't want to give too much away what happened in their fight to be able to be released from prison. So let's jump ahead to the movie and in its relation to any kind of fact.
Well, there was a film version of this story that was made in the 1950s. It was a film called The Decks Ran Red. It was made in 1958. And it was when the filmmakers did it, they said it was a true story. It was based upon the mutiny on board the Harry A. Berwyn. But I have to tell you that they really butchered the history to a large extent. The movie was, it had potential. I mean, it was a fairly big budget production, and it had some pretty prominent actors in it. James Mason was in it, and Dorothy Dandridge, who was emerging as one of the better known actresses of the day. But they changed all the details of the case, whereas the actual case occurred on board a sailing vessel in the year 1905. They updated the story to take place on a ship in the present day, being the 1950s, and they had it take place in the Pacific Ocean off of New Zealand on board a Liberty ship that had a crew of 30 people on it, which was completely different from what actually happened. And I mentioned Dorothy Dandridge. She was one of the stars of the movie. Mm-hmm. And she was she played this sort of exotic, sexually alluring.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Now, New Zealand Maori character who played the role of the temptress, and it added a whole bunch of romantic tension to the story. Whereas there were no women on board either of those ships in the real story, so that was completely embedded. I have to guess that when the filmmakers wrote the screenplay, they were probably basing it on some detective stories that were written for magazines back in the 1930s that were. Ostensibly based on the true story, but they embellished a lot of details. But anyway, this film that they made in the 1950s did not do well. It was a critical disappointment and a commercial flop, because people just thought it was lurid, it was overdramatic, and it was just kind of silly. Which is it's regretful, because it really did not do justice to the history of the events at all. And that's really my purpose in writing this book, is to go back and really document the events as they occurred, because I think in this case. truth is much more interesting than the fiction.
Absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these commercial messages.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
When you talked about the events, the incredible events with the white supremacists in 1898 in Wilmington, and then, interestingly, in 1905, as you write, that some people that were responsible for this insurgency then coming to the aid, at least somewhat, of these Black people that were accused of murder. You said it really was people going against type in this. But as time progressed as well, it seemed that, I wouldn't say a dramatic change, but there were changes in the attitude and in society in general that would seem to have helped the future of Adams and his partner, Sawyer.
Oh, yeah, that's very true. They were, again, not to give too much away, but I can tell you that they were released from prison. That happened in 1912 after they had been, they'd served more than 6 years behind bars. And they actually moved to New York, where they had jobs with Mr. Warner and his attorney, the guys who had been so influential in getting them clemency.
Right.
I'm not entirely clear on where they went after that. Unfortunately, the record sort of go cold on where they moved to and where they lived after that. But we know they got out of prison, and that's again. I just have to say that it really was a striking turn of events for that time period. We might ask, why did these people act against type? Why did they put forth so much effort to correct this injustice? Why did they work in favor of these Black guys who had been accused of murdering white people? You might be tempted to say, well, it was all altruistic on their part, or they just felt it was appropriate to be kind and merciful and so forth. I suspect it's also because by 1905 and 1910, Jim Crow by that time had become so entrenched, and white supremacy had been so well established in the South that the white establishment by that time really did not feel that they were under threat in any way. They were firmly in control, and so maybe they could afford to be merciful in a few cases like this, sort of as a means of maybe trying to be benevolent and trying to express a sense of noblesse oblige in a few cases like that. So it might be tempting to overstate whether this really reflects any kind of benevolence on their part. But if nothing else, the reason I wrote this book is to provide a sense of hope, because here's a case that occurred in the very worst of times, in the very worst of places, as far as race relations and how the very worst of times as far as race relations are concerned. And here's a case where, despite all of the bad history and all of the bad demographics and the bad racial dynamics, justice was actually able to prevail, in a sense. So in these days, especially when we hear nothing but nothing in the media except pessimism about race relations and oppression, marginalization, white supremacy, and so forth, well, times were a lot worse back then. And even then, it was possible for justice to prevail. So if there's any message that I'm trying to convey with this book, then that would be it, that it was possible for things to turn out well, even in far worse times.
It's very interesting when you talk about altruism and ulterior motives. There was, and we didn't talk about it, but in your book, you chronicled this very exciting surprise intervention for financial reasons tied to the Berwind along the way. And what's interesting is a testament to that the media and other people involved could see through this seemingly transparent attempt to hijack this, what the proceedings were going well on behalf of Adams and Sawyer.
Well, that's true. I mean, the whole 7 year drama, legal drama, was just filled with ups and downs. It was like a roller coaster. And there were several times when Adams and Sawyer felt like they really were making progress, that they were gonna get out of prison. And there were also a couple of times when the ship owners, they tried to intervene in the case again, and they tried to make up a new story about how, for example, they had been they had been threatened by Adams and Sawyer about that they supposedly had made threats that if they got out of prison, they were going to hunt down and try to assassinate the fellows who owned the ship. And again, I think they probably did that just through their own financial selfishness. They didn't want to take a chance on them getting out of prison because it might cost them money. They'd have to pay off their insurers or have to pay those salvage fees that I mentioned earlier. And it was just a very, very transparent, very, really, really cruel thing for them to do at that stage. But fortunately, as you said, the courts were able to see through it.
It's interesting, too, when you talk about the employment after they were released. And you mentioned that the attorney, Roundtree and Paschal, they're employing them. One of them employing Adams to be his personal valet and the other one working in the law offices. And again, testament to saying to anyone that would look at this, saying, we trust these people enough to work with us and around us. And even, in fact, let one of them go and make a deposit at a bank. So a very striking difference from the time that they were convicted.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And, you know, when the, you know, I know about this really from the newspaper accounts that were written at the time. And, you know, it's, again, you have to cringe a little bit when you read the language that the journalists used back then, because it's all very, very paternalistic. And even when you see that it was written with the best of intentions, but they talked about how Adams and Sawyer went to work for their saviors and their benefactors.
Yeah.
And they were quoted as saying how grateful they were for the intervention of Mr. Warner and his attorney, and how they were going to pledge their lives to upright living and so forth. And it's just you get the sense, of course, they were expected to be deferential, and they were expected to show gratitude, and to be essentially, they were expected to be lifelong servants of these guys because they had done them this great favor and so forth. And again, that's a little bit cringy, but the language of the news reports is still, you know, steeped in racial prejudice to that extent. But at the same time, there's no denying that the outcome was really, really exceptional and completely unexpected and positive in the end.
Absolutely. And historic as well.
Very much so.
And does something to, I guess, downplay or diminish somewhat, again, just somewhat, the events of 1898 and further on as well.
Well, there's no sugarcoating what happened in 1898, but at the very least, I mean, this story is you might call it sort of a flickering candle in the darkness. It's an example of how, given an exceptional confluence of circumstances, I mean, given the fact that this was a federal case, and because it was a case where the president had a chance to weigh in and offer clemency, and frankly, because the court procedures were taken more seriously because it was a federal case. And also given the fact that, I think this is also important, the victims in the case, the men who were killed, they were not Wilmington natives. They didn't have families who lived in that area, and they didn't have friends who were serving on the juries. If that had been the case, then I'm not sure that the reporters in Wilmington would have been as willing to be discerning and listen to the testimony as clearly and, you know, point out the weaknesses in the prosecution case and so forth. But these guys, Adams and Sawyer, I mean, as unlucky as they were to have been on board that ship serving with Henry Scott, I mean, they were fortunate in a number of other ways that they were able to gain favor among so many people in Wilmington, and people in Wilmington were willing to listen to them and believe in them. That was very, very lucky and very unusual.
And you also write, though, that there's an important letter written to a very important figure that plays into this. And as you say, that letter was typewritten. So someone that was a supporter at that prison likely helped in that. At the end of the book, you talk about when you and your brother were young and you became acquainted with the story of Stede Bonnet, who was a pirate just a mile from Cape Fear River. Tell us why you included this little bit of a story and all the help that you had to be able to put this credible story together.
Well, I grew up in North Carolina. I've lived here all my life. And when I was a child, and you know, even now, you know, my family, we usually spent a good portion of our summers down in Brunswick County along the beaches near Southport, because that's been one of our favorite vacation spots over the years. And you know, one of the for tourists who, you know, spend time around Southport, you know, one of the notable, you know, historical tie-ins that people associate with Southport is the pirates. It used to be a hunting ground for pirates back in the early 1700s and so forth. And that's just really neat. It's one of those interesting cultural things, that cultural tie-ins that people associate with the area. And, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I thought pirate stories were really cool. And so I became familiar with some of those as I was growing up. And later on, I came across this particular story sort of by accident. This is my second book. And after I finished my first one, I knew that I wanted to write another true crime book. And it wouldn't, I'd like to focus on the area that I know best, which is Eastern North Carolina. And so I came across this story sort of by accident. I came across a historical review article that was written about it back in 2014, which covered the basic details of, you know, the trials and Adams and Sawyer and Scott and so forth. And I was really amazed that nobody had ever written a definitive book about it yet. And so that's what I resolved to do, because it was right up my alley, you might say.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations on Ship of Blood. Thank you so much for this interview. Ship of Blood, Mutiny and Slaughter Aboard the Harry A. Berwind and the Quest for Justice, Charles Oldham. For those that might want to take a look at this, is there an Amazon page, Facebook or website that you might take a look?
Well, actually, the best way to order a copy is to order directly from my publisher.
Great.
And that website, well, my publisher is known as Beach Glass Books. And the website is www.beachglassbooks, all one word, beachglassbooks.com. And they are based in Richmond, Virginia. And if for anyone who's interested in a copy, that's the recommendation that I make, is to order directly from my publisher.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Charles Oldham. Ship of Blood, Mutiny and Slaughter Aboard the Harry A. Berwind. It has been a fascinating interview. Thank you so much. You have a great evening.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.
Right.